good morning on this blustery Thursday morning. Welcome to the seventh and final framework session for 2015. Over the course of this year, it has been our privilege to host a variety of distinguished panelists. They've covered a variety of very pertinent topics around the life sciences and environment here in the state. I can assure you today will be no different. Before we get started, however, I would like to thank our sponsor, Miles Printing, for sponsoring this event this morning. We are always grateful for the partnerships and certainly appreciate their committed support over the course of this entire year. BioCrossroads, together with Fager Baker Daniel Consulting, released a report this week outlining the CTSA program. The program has been around since 2006, and what we hope to capture was not only the background and history of the program, but also where they saw it heading in the future, and ultimately how the Indiana CTSI is situated within that continuum, and how they will best be able to leverage not only their expertise, but also the strengths and diversity and collaboration of the life sciences community here in central Indiana and throughout the entire state. While I don't want to go into too much detail, knowing what our two distinguished panelists are going to be covering today, as I mentioned, the CTSA program was launched in 2006 by the NIH to provide a more effective and efficient way to translate basic science into novel therapies. Today, the program includes 62 CTSA hubs across the country. Indiana's is led by the Indiana School of Medicine in partnership with Purdue University and the University of Notre Dame. It plays a vital role in our life sciences community and and ties directly into the health innovation clusters that we have so prevalent here as well. Moving forward, it is our hope that it will work in tandem with the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, as well as the recently announced 16 Tech Innovation Community. Today we'll hear from Deborah Lappin, principal at FBD and co-author of this report, along with the director of the Indiana CTSI, Dr. Natha Shekhar. So to kick things off, I would now like to introduce Deborah Lappin. Deborah leads the health and biosciences team at Fager Baker Daniel Consulting and also serves as counsel to Fager Baker Daniels. She is a leading strategist in health science policy consulting with academic, government, industry, and nonprofit institutions on a number of important topics to advance policy and promote public health. Deborah is a recognized national spokesperson on public engagement and patient centricity in science and medicine, and serves as an advisor to the NIH and to the CDC, and probably most importantly, BioCrossroads. Please join me in welcoming Deborah.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you all for coming this morning and for allowing me to present our report and our findings and our thoughts on a program of really immense importance to the United States as science and medicine shifts and change and as the intersection between, we'll get the mic right while I give you the comments, the intersection between basic research, translational or applied research, and ultimate clinical care have become essentially linked. And this has happened just in the last many years. So it's very new to see this linkage rather than silos. And we'll have a good conversation about that today. I think you've all been given a report that our firm, Fager Baker Daniels, was very pleased to be able to author. I want to recognize the primary author, Dave Zook.
He's in our audience, Dave Wave. Dave chairs our health and our entire Fager BD consulting practice. I also want to recognize Troy Heggie, of course, David Johnson, Chris, who just introduced me, and a number of other people at BioCrossroads who really decided that they wanted to have this deeper dive and to examine how the Indiana Life Sciences and the CTSI was positioned against some global comparator or some national comparators. So since I can't see my slides, I'm going to have to use some here in front of me, so forgive me for that, but we'll move forward. The program at the NIH has evolved, and I'm going to give you 10 minutes of history of how the NIH came to change its $30 billion enterprise to have this focus now embraced by Congress on translation. So in the 1960s and moving into the 1970s, there was a kind of rich interplay between basic PhD scientists and MD PhDs. And as people look back, this was a time when the physician in the clinic was speaking often to the basic researcher, and the loop was just sort of seamless. As we grew in our investment, however, because the NIH was $12 billion then, maybe less, the focus on translation created 80 freestanding general clinical research centers, and they were to begin to focus on how to develop a clinical and translational science. And as people look back, they saw a separation beginning to occur between the basic research enterprise and the clinical research enterprise and the GCRCs themselves. And I think you had at least one, if not two.
One.
You did not have a pediatric unit.
Right.
And there were like 16 pediatrics, the rest were adults. But they began to become their silos, and the lack of communication between the basic research and the clinical research became a recognized problem, a significant problem. We began to see at the same time the doubling of the NIH budget and a real expectation that what was happening at the NIH would contribute to human health. By 2008, there was an interesting report that there were 800,000 papers, but by 2011, there were only 21 new drugs. And the thought was, where is all the basic science going to help human health? And if we're going to double the NIH budget, what is the return to human health? These were very, very big conversations. 2006, Elias Zerhouni, who is then the director, and I'll talk about the basis for his decision, launched the CTSA program. In 2008, IU with Purdue and Notre Dame applied and got a very high score on their first round application. They reapplied 5 years later, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, second in the nation. Let me say that again, second in the nation. This is a highly competitive program. So that score was stunning. And maybe we'll cross-examine and announce a little more later. Be thinking of your questions as I speak. And finally, Congress saw how important this was and dissolved what was the old NCRR, National Center for Research Resources, and created NCATS, the National Center for Advancing Translational Science. Whoops. No, that's good. So here's the path to where we are today. That Zerhouni, when he came in, recognized this problem, created something called the roadmap. Maybe many of you are familiar. But this was new language in 04, that we needed to think differently about science. Big data, genomics, all of the omics were emerging. We needed to have three things, he said. New teams, new ways of bringing to the basic science, bioengineering, bioinformatics, biostatistics, things that were needed that had to be part of a team. We needed to have new pathways. We needed to look at mechanisms of diseases. Today, this is common parlance, but it really wasn't then. We were thinking of cancer, heart, arthritis, everything as being a disease-based rather than a mechanism and a pathway. And we had big data coming onto the fore. And we have things like biostorage, and we'll talk about that today, where biospecimens and what we could learn about genotype and phenotype when we have the kind of tools and deep resources. Who was amalgamating these resources? Where would they be? Where would they be lodged in the academic environment of clinical research? So then in 05, the program was conceived, the first awards, and as Zerhouni was going out of office, he anticipated the new era of preventive, preemptive, personalized, participatory medicine. And that last word was such a forethought to the focus today on patient-focused drug development. I had somebody say to me the other day, well, hasn't drug development always been patient-focused? And when you think about it, well, of course, yes, it has been, but the patient experience, the understanding of natural history, the understanding of clinically meaningful endpoints in diseases, what should be measured in drug development? This conversation is very new, and I remember I couldn't understand in 07 just how prescient that conversation was that Zerhouni began. So, where we are today. We have a CPSA program. It's housed in the NCATS Division of Clinical Innovation. There's a Division of Preclinical Innovation and a Division of Clinical Innovation. It supports a national consortium of 62 centers. You'll see where they're located. And you'll see a real dearth still in rural America. And one time, Dr. Austin, who runs the program, maybe about 2 years ago, he said, I look at this map, and what we can't have is sort of a country club of entitled academic institutions, where if you're fortunate enough to live there, you might get into some translational program. We have to figure out how to spread this wealth, this knowledge, and the resources that are centered in the academic institutions you see here across a vast country so that all Americans benefit from this immense investment. It's $500 million a year, 565, about that. Second largest single program at the whole NIH. The cancer clinical trials are bigger, larger, the clinical cancer centers.
They're about similar.
About the same. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about one of the two largest programs ever in the history of the NIH. So Dr. Austin says his mission is to catalyze methods and technologies that enhance the development of diagnostics and therapeutics across a range of human disease. While the CTSAs are to be disease agnostic, they prove their worth when they tackle a disease. So nobody can ignore that. We have to have both. I like these next two slides because they're from Dr. Austin, and they say, what are the problems we are now today in 2015 challenged to tackle? We have to learn to do predictive toxicology, different, better, predictive efficacy, de-risking undruggable targets, data interoperability, biomarker qualification. We have to have clinical trial networks that speak to each other, share data, have common infrastructure. Patient recruitment is under science. There's a new science of patient recruitment. Electronic health records. Well, one needs to just stop right here and say that John Kansky and others who work on this, that IU has, and the whole Indianapolis area has been so far ahead of this game because of Regan Street, that it's truly such a distinguishing feature that you just, yeah, of course, you've been working at this for years. But the rest of the nation does not still know how to do this, and it has to happen because the data in our health records is the immense research resources for a new way of doing clinical research. Harmonized IRB, clinical diagnostic criteria, patient-oriented research, adaptive clinical trial designs. Let's fail fast. Let's move molecules into a single adaptive proof-of-concept protocol and get industry to think differently and have our academic institutions, because this is really elegant science in terms of how to do this, be a place that can look at the clinical trial of the future. Adherence to medicine, a science. And then methods for a better impact on health. We'll come back to that. The organizational challenges, he notes, data transparency, IP management. I don't think that'll ever go away. Integration of project management. How do we learn from industry? Carmel Egan is here somewhere, who has had a project management for years, all project management at Lilly. How do we learn project management and bring that discipline into our academic centers? And I suggest you're doing it here. Incentives and credits for improving health. Is this a new burden imposed on the program, or is it something they're really capable of doing? Training, educating, a new way of thinking about team science, and new public-private partnerships. We see that Europe's way ahead of us in this area, where they allow industry and academia to work to blend resources, to bring in-kind resources to a common project. We live in public funding, private funding. Never should the two meet, and it's really going to hurt us in terms of global competition if we don't learn with transparency to bring resources together to advance a particular problem. So, recent developments. In 2013, the IOM was asked to look at this entire program. In 2014, NCATS asked a working group to dive into what the IOM said, and the working group came back with a report with four key areas. We need to look at our workforce development in clinical science differently. We need to engage the stakeholder community, the idea of participatory-based research, community-based participatory research that came out of the 90s needs to be elevated to a new way of having the community and the patient involved in the entire research continuum. We need to look at an integration of our clinical research across a lifespan, understanding the immense threat of Alzheimer's that's not being measured. Cognitive assessments are not being taken in other clinical trials for other diseases. Why are we not gaining information across a lifespan in our longitudinal studies? And then we need to create a new concept of hubs so that any CTSA award is a hub for getting information and getting talent and resources distributed out from that site. So the 2015 RFP is expected now to be refashioned to respond even more discreetly to these recommendations. It will focus on funding program priorities, expanding, we think, to more sites, potentially with less money. This gets harder and harder. An emphasis on interdisciplinary team science. How do we reward that in promotion and tenure committees? How do we allow multiple people to be a primary author on a paper? And I think Ananth's really going after this in a truly innovative way. Creating new models for patient-oriented research. And it is a priority for the administration, for a conservative Congress that wants to say, if we're going to continue to take money and make it for the NIH to move from $30 billion to, say, $31 or $32 billion, we're going to take that money away from something else. It could be strategic oil reserves. It could be, you know, changing reimbursement on drugs. But we're going to find the money. It's not going to be just out of the blue. If we're going to do that, show us how you're improving human health. So the program today has the hubs. It has new, wonderful, innovative trial innovation centers and recruitment innovation centers where knowledge on the sciences of both and the infrastructure will be shared, and a new support and infrastructure so that multi-site studies can be done with greater efficiencies across the enterprise. A new single IRB, multi-site centers, where the NCAS is going to ask that they agree to rely on one IRB and that there not be local tweaks. Can you imagine getting this accomplished? But if you do, industry is going to want to come to the academic infrastructure because of the efficiency. We want to have trial management agreements that are standardized so that the time to set up your trial in the academic center is reduced significantly and the time, therefore, to get a drug to humans is increased or decreased. These efficiencies are immense, and industry is seeing them everywhere. And if the government doesn't respond, as I think they are, the academic industry is not going to keep up with the private industry in how we conduct our trials. So here are the domain task forces. Let me see if I can. One more. Yeah, this is how the NCAS is set up today, and I think Ananth serves on many of these committees, and today Ananth serves on the entire NCAS advisory board. Is that an appointment by Francis Collins or
yes,
by the Secretary of
Secretary.
Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Yes.
It's a big deal. So there's a domain task force on workforce development, collaboration, integration across the lifespan, methods and processes, and informatics. And I think there's a new one on patient focus and patient priorities in research. So now I'm going to turn to you for the next 5 minutes about our report. I hope you've had a chance to scan it. If you haven't, what we were challenged to do was to look at the Indiana CTSI, which I'll just call the CTSI, in the context of what it's doing in Indiana, what it's doing across five comparator institutions, and is it positioned to go forward in the way that it's been positioned in the past and be a leader in this program. And I will say that it's punching above its weight, and you'll see that in a moment when I look at our comparator institutions. So how did we do this? We did a broad literature review. We've absorbed everything about the CTSA program. We selected five other sites besides IU and had in-depth interviews with those site leaders, looked at public reported data, and then went outside and double-tested our conclusions with some key opinion leaders. We chose three comparable hubs in terms of the size of the populations, the size of the grant, and then we took two other outliers and looked at those. And let me just show you a little bit about how the comparators that we chose. So here you see IU at a funding level of just under $7 million for the CTSA against $150 million of total NIH funding. We looked at Albert Einstein, a similar CTSA funding level, and a very similar NIH funding level, but a rather remarkable difference in the population of the region, sitting there in the middle of New York, 20 million. Emory, similar funding level, total NIH is 270 million, quite a bit more, has half of the bioscience enterprise surrounding Emory. Their envy of your ability to work with industry was just immense. They have big bioengineering with Georgia Tech. They have an admirable diverse health disparities. They collaborate with Morehouse. They are a leader in how to recruit disparate populations into trials. We can learn from them. But they have no relationships with industry. It was pretty stunning. Then we went to the University of Texas, UT Southwest. And the first thing you hear from them is, well, we have five Nobel laureates. I mean, this is a basic science dream place, truly. Okay, so we don't have five basic science Nobel laureates. So you start to see some of the differences here. They have a similar funding, as we do, for their CTSA. They have a large bioscience surrounding enterprise. And they have the same size, actually, of NIH funding as we do. And the last two are our beautiful outliers, WashU and Stanford. And you look at the size of the bioscience enterprise surrounding Stanford, so it's no surprise that they are highly entrepreneur-focused in a way that, again, we can learn from them about how do you stimulate entrepreneurship, because clearly we're rich in those opportunities in Stanford. And WashU has 1,000 members, 22 cores. It's a pretty big enterprise. It's a big school of public health, so pretty impressive. Key findings across the hubs. Every one of the folks we interviewed said that because of the CTSI, or the CTSA, they all have different names, their elevation of clinical research within the academic research enterprise had changed over the last 8 years. That it is a new conversation, that basic scientists are thinking about translation in a way they never had, and that clearly these investments now, after 8 years, are changing the way the academic research enterprise at the provost and the president's level talk about science and medicine. Blurring the lines between the academic research institution and the delivery of health, that every one of them said, we are challenged under the Affordable Care Act, the new understanding of value and delivery, not to let it take 17 years for a clinical finding in research to make it into clinical care, that this has to be collapsed, and there's a new value in the academic research institution that institutions like IU Health are seeing, and that's being repeated everywhere. There's a concern about the direction of the program. It's not a surprising one. The second one here is that the standardization could take away our flexibility and creativity. That isn't a surprise, but we can talk about that. And there's a real concern, as you saw here with IU, that if we start tying the CTSA to the total funding from NIH, those of us who are star programs are really going to be challenged because the rest of the institution around us may not be bringing in that denominator, and we're being forced to use that as the percentage against which our ceiling of funding will be determined. I want to move now, actually, to Ananta's program. It's a remarkable program, and Ananta, we can come back to many of these slides, perhaps, as you discuss with us, but you will see here that this program in Indiana has created a door for the investigator to come into the hub, and the investigator is given a navigator, and he's given access to the CTSI Informatics and Data Analysis Set Core, and then given down to program managers who will help that investigator learn how to submit the highly competitive grant and the successful outcomes one hopes through a closed loop generate new project ideas that come back up through the community, observing what is needed, through the IU health system, observing what is needed, and then coming back up and into the door of the CTSI. We have a couple of slides that show the complexity, but it's an elegant complexity, of the academic, applied, industry, patient care resources and assets that the Indiana CTSI draws upon. So not only is it Purdue, Notre Dame, and IU, but the CTSI has created something called SPARC, which is a strategic pharmaceutical academic research consortium across 17 Midwest institutions. So way ahead of what was asked for by the NIH, we here at the CTSI were creating this kind of network to share resources. So that outreach has been impressive. Regan Streif, IHI, these have led in the idea of how to use health system EHR to produce observations that will feed into clinical research and big data emerging. The Applied Translation Center here with the IBRI, and I understand I can see 16 Tech if I look right there. This is all new, and how IBRI, we're going to ask Ananta that, will become integrated with this. What is the vision for the integration that will unfold? And industry. Amazing sets of industry relationships here, many of which are noted. And finally, patient care. So what are the comparative strengths? And Ananta won't say this himself, but he's too modest. But truly, he is an investigator who's uniformly recognized as a leader in this program. Industry commitment at the highest levels. The co-investment across translation, commercial, and health impact that's happening here in the community, and the incredible regional life science infrastructure. This is all happening today against the future challenges for the program. I mentioned, and I will say it again, the amount of money we're putting into $30 billion has to be tied to drugs that come out of the FDA. The public and the private productivity are linked in terms of the way our Congress will look at investing in this program. And we have future opportunities in the program where we see this complete product life cycle of basic research to patient-oriented research to clinical trials and to population research and fed back in. I'll conclude with, I'm going to come back. We're going to leave that slide up for you. Well, we didn't get that slide in. So let me just say, I want to conclude with this. There's a dynamic context in which the CTSI exhibits significant strength as a platform that drives the development of therapies and builds collaborations. Our report suggests that there are few comparable mechanisms existing in the region with the skills, flexibility, and the ability to bridge the components of the sector and the regional investment in biosciences that has been happening all along in Indiana. The CTSI is the bridge. Creating a new bridge would be illogical. The characteristics differentiate this CTSI from other hubs, and a rich array of health-focused organizations, and I'm hoping that we'll hear from some today, from OrthoWorks. I know we're going to call on iHive, we're going to call on BioStorage, and we're going to ask others of you to talk about the integration with this translational platform. And the array of relationships in Indiana will and must materially factor into how Anantha begins to paint the picture for what he will call CTSI version 3.0. What will that look like? How will it relate with 16 tech? How will it look at big data, at imaging, at the tools and the resources that are coming down the path toward us? I think I've gone a little over, but we're going to now move up, and I'm going to invite Anantha to join me. And we'll keep that slide that shows the CTSI at the center of a pretty vibrant enterprise. So, Anantha.
Thank you. Thanks.
I know many of you know Anantha, but I'm going to take a moment.
No, it's okay.
Can I introduce
That's all right.
So, of course, he directs the CTSI. I remember in 2008 when you were getting ready to put in the grant application that you sort of had all the input you needed and went off somewhere. I don't know where you went to, but you went off into hiding for about 10 days and came back out. It was like Moses coming down. Somehow the tablets have been written, and this you thought, how could a single individual pull that off? It was just a beautiful thing. So you also now, in addition to your role leading the statewide translation, you lead a basic and clinical research program in neuropsychology here. And you really looked at brain disorders and a number across the neuropsych. And this is a huge, huge growing area for the CTSIs, actually, and moving into Alzheimer's. It's one of the first trial innovation center focuses. So with that in mind, let's begin. What makes you unique?
I don't think
CTSI unique.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the easier question. I don't think I'm unique. I just work hard. The CTSI is indeed unique because it's one of the only real statewide CTSI that actually brings together the state's research-intensive universities, as well as all of the state's biotechnology industry together. So I don't think there is a single CTSA hub in the country that does that in a comprehensive statewide manner. So I think that's a testament not to my grant writing ability, but I think it's a testament to the amazing resources and collaborative spirit that we have here in Indiana.
Has it been easy to bring three academic institutions together to do this?
Well, someone once remarked, I think it was a Purdue vice president, who said, "This is the first big grant IU and Purdue have ever written together." That was in 2008, but since then I think there have been a great number of collaborations. But yes, I think it is, it's bridged a lot of that gap. And then Notre Dame actually joined us a year after we got funded, so they voluntarily came and joined.
Can you give us an example of some of those successes in the collaboration between the institutions?
I can think of several, but I would say there are at least half a dozen technologies that we have been able to connect between Purdue, for example, engineering, and our medical researchers here. One good example that is actually now currently being marketed is a speech device that helps Parkinson's patients. And that was actually designed by a biomedical engineer at Purdue and a neurologist and a speech pathologist, and eventually was the prototype was built by Purdue biomedical engineers, and then now it's gone public and it's being sold all over. So that's one example. We've also had variety of, I'd say, collaborative large grants now between IU and Purdue, between IU and Notre Dame. I'd say we have at least three or so large projects with the industry that are with Lilly and with Takeda, as well as now with Roche Diagnostics.
That's actually where I wanted to go next.
Yeah.
The collaboration with industry, when we talked to literally all five of the other institutions, probably a little less, everybody recognized that you were doing something special here in Indiana. And yes, it's with Lilly, but it's not just with Lilly. And so speak about that, just the breadth of the industry collaboration, where do you see those going? Even though I'm going to ask you to just describe 3.0, I want you to tell me what you see the future for the collaboration.
Yeah, I think, we started out with Lilly because that was by far the industry that we had been working with most closely at that point. So we started out, very interestingly, not with what I would call a drug development program per se, which would have been much more complicated with IP and all of the issues you mentioned. So we started with Lilly in collaboration with an education program. One of the big challenges for industry is to get the kind of workforce they need, especially in very specific areas. And one area where it's a big problem is clinical pharmacology, early development, modeling, appropriate recognition of how molecules behave once given to a human being. So that whole field was, emerging. There's really no training program for that in the country. The only one currently in the world, other than ours, is in Sweden. So we said, wouldn't this be a great idea that we could actually start training people here with Lilly's scientists and our scientists being co-mentors? So we started that, and we now have, it graduates about 2 people every year. We have graduated about 10. Every one of those graduates, even before they finish their second year, are hired by an industry. So we have people hired by Merck and Novartis and Lilly and all kinds of industry. So we started that way, but then we moved on to discovery collaborations with Lilly through Spark, you mentioned. And then Takeda came and joined that and said, we want to put money into it and use academic resources to do collaborative research.
Okay, so now peel that one back. Takeda comes and talk about Spark, because I think it is unique.
Yeah.
We felt it was, and if you agree, tell us why. And then tell what would Takeda be paying for?
So essentially, this was a very sort of, somewhat revolutionary idea. It was two pharma coming together, jointly putting resources with 5 large academic medical centers to do discovery research. And every team had a Lilly scientist, a Takeda scientist, a WashU scientist, a Northwestern scientist, and an Indiana scientist, for example. So here we have truly collaborative research of the best scientists from all of these 7 organizations simply doing discovery, as opposed to worrying about who owns the IP, who funds the research, where is the public-private conflicts, et cetera. So it's really remarkable. So we've now funded 5 such programs.
And can you tell us what areas they're in?
They're mostly in the area of autoimmunity and immunology and autoimmune diseases. So they're focusing on usually what I would say autoimmunity with not big fields, but things like scleroderma, for example, that are life-threatening but not as common as rheumatoid arthritis.
What has been the biggest obstacle to that kind of collaboration?
Well, most of it is trying to get that original, agreement with all the organizations. 5 tech transfer offices and 2 pharma legal, offices. But once we got past that, the scientists just love it. They want to do science. They really don't care whether they're in industry or in a medical school. So that was one of the very positive things. And I think Chris Austin's vision is that that should happen everywhere at the national level to really make the kind of discoveries we need to make. The other areas we're now starting to work closely with is the Koch Industries. We are partnering with them on several what I would call more stem cell-based or cell therapy-based approaches. Similarly, we have started working with Roche Diagnostics in genomic medicine and looking at more precision-based, genetically targeted medical treatments. So I mean, these are, I think, you know, really, we have the world's leaders here in diagnostics, in therapeutics, as well as in device industry.
Yeah.
So we should be doing that. So our hope is to do that more, and we're beginning to also discuss some collaborations with Biomet and a few other orthopedics industries.
I want to move to the notion of training scientists to become team scientists and how antithetical that is to what we ask of basic researchers, and to, you know, claim your research, keep your data close until you're ready to be recognized. We all know that story. And how do you begin to change a culture?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the longer roads, and we're still working on it. As you all know, the whole academic enterprise is built on this, you know, independent investigator who has his discovery program, who has his own grants, who writes his papers, who, you know, is a single sort of scientific leader of his or her fiefdom. And that's what we incentivize people to do. That's what we promote people based on those accomplishments. So the entire academic sort of incentive process was set in that way for decades, even maybe centuries now. So now suddenly we realize that to do great science, there is no single laboratory, even labs that have Nobel Prize winners as their leads and have 500 people working under them, or even a Lilly research laboratory with thousands of people working on them, cannot necessarily do all the science that needs to be done to solve some of these diseases. So you have to be in a team. You have to work as a team. And but we have no good incentive pathway for people to work on a team. If you work on a team and you're a middle author on 5 papers and you're a co-investigator on 3 grants, you may be doing phenomenal work, but it's hard to get promoted in a university.
And yet your work is the foundational piece
of
allowing the entire project to success. So this is, what about, I was impressed when we spoke with you about a cluster training program that you've launched, and maybe I made more of it than I thought, but I really want the audience to hear that, because it seems so remarkable in the way to start down the break down the barriers.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we are changing now in terms of both of our promotion and tenure criteria. We're making changes there for incentivizing people to be more team players. But what we're thinking is that we really have to train a whole new generation of scientists in a different model than we, myself and others, have been traditionally trained. So one of the things we're experimenting with, I think which you mentioned, is that rather than give individual training grants, so typically we'll give a PhD student a stipend to do their PhD, or a postdoc stipend to do their postdoc training, or even a assistant professor a career development award to do their research. But rather than give it to independent people, we want to give it to a cluster, so that there is a graduate student, a postdoc, an assistant professor, all are funded together as a team. And the success of the whole team is what maintains the funding, rather than their individual success. It's a radical idea. We'll see. I might get slapped down by the university, but I don't think so. But we'll try to experiment with it.
And then you said the East are first author on the paper that's published in their domain journal.
Yes. So that's what we're thinking, is that we will create new models, but it's still an early experiment.
So talk about 16 Tech and IBRI and how you see the future for the collaborations that you'll have.
Yeah, I think, you know, the focus of the IBRI, of course, as most of you know, is obesity, diabetes, and metabolic diseases. So it's a very sort of specific statewide problem-focused institute. But the model will be that there will be great science going on there and a great deal of industry collaboration going on there, which, you know, of course, is perfectly consistent with what our CTSI and our institution wants to do. So to that end, IBRI is already a partner in the CTSI, just like IU, Purdue, and Lilly, and others are partners. What does that mean? It means several things. One, that any IBRI scientist has access to the full resources of all of the CTSI partner institutions. That includes graduate students from Purdue or postdocs from Bloomington, et cetera, but also all the technology cores and resources. In addition, we will be providing them all of the basic infrastructure, such as, you know, grants management, grant submission, animal housing, etc. So it'll be a very integrated institute, and we want to collaborate with them in science and not create barriers like, well, here is an independent institute that's not owned by the university, therefore we should create all kinds of barriers to protect each other. So that's the process we are going through now. We're close to signing all of the appropriate MOUs. One of our faculty will be their interim science chief scientific officer. So there's going to be a lot of integration and collaboration.
So Dow AgriScience can see how what it's doing could flow through in metabolic and health and into actual clinical.
Yes. And one of the things we're thinking about jointly starting between the CTSI and the IBRI is actually a big data sciences center or a core, so that they're going to be investing in data and analytics, bioinformatics. We're going to be investing in data analytics and bioinformatics. Why not join forces and create a national standard, best in the state institute, a center together. So those are the kinds of things we're talking about.
So that leads us to 3.0, right?
Yes.
What is CTSI 3.0? What's the next grant?
Yeah, the
you
next
one more in you, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think my dean says you got two more in you, but I'm not sure. But yes, I think so there are several things that are, as you mentioned, in the CTSA 3.4 that we'll have to address. One is the ability to discover both patients and patient-related information, but equally importantly, biological discoveries through large data, large patient databases. So to that end, you know, with some of the resources we have, we can actually be leading. We have a great deal of electronic health records data across the state. Now we have a tool called I2B2 that we have rolled out here. With that, one can actually search 15 CTSA's electronic health records from here in Indianapolis. So you can essentially say how many diabetes patients are there, not just at IU Health or Eskenazi or even in Indiana, but how many are there in Indiana plus, you know, UPenn, plus Johns Hopkins, plus Harvard. So we can look at that. You know, it's all de-identified, but you actually have ability to look at those kinds of information. So the idea, and this will be particularly relevant for rare diseases where you may have, you know, three kids in Indiana who have this and, you know, three others in California, and how do you discover that cohort and then study them? So that's the big data management and analytics would be one of the big areas we'll be building. And our core strength we'll continue to build on is industry academic collaborations. And we're really, as I said, beginning to develop some collaborations with additional industry partners. Then finally, I think the next, for us, the 3.0, the biggest, I would say, ambitious thing that we'll go after is one that you didn't touch on in when you were doing the comparative tables. If anybody noticed that, Indiana was ranked 42nd in health status. So we're really, compared to all of those, you know, the CTSAs, we are in the lower tenth of this country. So we've got to address population health. We've got to address the health status of Indiana. So we've already started working on infant mortality. We've started a large community grant to address infant mortality. And then diabetes prevention would be our second grant. So I think we're going to go on the other side. For some of you who already know, the CTSI just put in a practice transformation award, and we got a $47 million grant from Medicare and Center for Medicare and Medicaid to truly do that, to transform basic best practices into patient care. So I think our biggest reach goal will be actually move Indiana's health status up.
I'm going to stop there. It's tremendous just to hear you walk through the program and its scope. We've asked a few people and asked them to start off our discussion with Anantha, and I will turn to the audience after we look at Lori and Cheryl and John. And if you have questions, please get the mic. This is being recorded, so we do want you to have the mic. But John Kansky from iHi, Lori Ball from BioStorage, and Cheryl with OrthoWorks, do you have, any one of you want to start? Lori, I'll call on you first.
Sure. So just a few words about BioStorage Technologies. We are an Indiana headquartered company, but primarily a global service company. And I must say that our engagement with IU School of Medicine and CTSI has been very impressive with what's going on right here in the state of Indiana. Most of our clients are out of the state, and many of them are out of the country, so it's a real pleasure to be doing business in Indiana. But what we've been exposed to is a data integration project with IU School of Medicine, the CTSI, IU School of Medicine, Komen Tissue Bank had a need to collect and migrate some data and around sample management. What's been clear for us is that, you know, we started as a sample-centric company, and so very much focused on the physical sample management of research. And then it was pretty clear that as the industry evolved into precision medicine and patient-centric care, it became important for the research community to endorse virtual sample management and virtual research. And I think Anantha has pointed out that the clear evolution that's continuing to gain some momentum is collaborative research in addition to that. And so in order to have collaborative research, you must have data integration and virtual abilities to manage. And it's clear that Indiana and CTSI specifically is leading the charge in many of those fronts. Ironically, Anantha and I actually met in China while we were both presenting, but he was presenting on what's going on in CTSI research in addition to the IU School of Medicine. And so when you're on a stage like that, it's clear that Indiana is a very impressive place to be when it comes to collaboration. So applause to you and to the state for opening the boundaries. Because in order for us to accelerate and enable research, we all must work together, even though it's counterintuitive for some of us to do that. So thank you for your leadership, and I think it's just the beginning.
Thanks.
John
Canty. John Canty from the Indiana Health Information Exchange. And listening to the presentation today, one of the things that I was reminded of and impressed by is the fact that there's a lot of assets in Indiana that are all necessary ingredients to achieve what we're able to achieve together. And I can't help but think about the health or information exchange role in that. We're the nation's largest health information exchange because of the work, the pioneering work of Regenstrief, more than 20 years ago now, which has resulted in the nation's largest interorganizational clinical data repository. Well, that's an asset. That's a very valuable asset. But it wouldn't be there to support research if it didn't also support patient care and now an emerging very valuable use to support population health management. So I think we're reminded by the presentations that educate us about the ecosystem that we're part of and the importance of doing what we do every day to support patient care, to support population health management, and so that asset is there to support research.
Phenomenal asset. And Cheryl Conley with OrthoWorks.
Thank you, and I'm actually going to go right for a question.
Okay.
For OrthoWorks, we represent the large orthopedic industry cluster that resides in northern Indiana. We have had a great opportunity with the School of Medicine to really get to understand more about CTSI, Regenstrief, but it has never been focused into orthopedics. So as you kind of think about into the future in 3.0, and some of these questions may be 4.0, for industry, specifically more device-related, it's very much about surgeon-scientist connectivity to translate, you know, ideas, you know, to patient care. And, you know, one of the things that came out of the study was, you know, the growing shift into most of the granting is going to PhD scientists and fewer, you know, MD, DO, you know, PhD folks. And I know it takes quite some time to grow that. So just curious if you've got thoughts about either how we get more surgeon scientists or how do you use more clinicians that may not be the PhDs to get more of that clinical input. So that's question one. And then the second question that kind of strikes me, particularly for industry, there was nothing about with CTSAs in general regarding economics. So health economics. You had mentioned earlier about Europe is ahead of us. You know, they require all new translations to also have a technology assessment tied to, you know, how does it take costs out. So that may be a 4.0 topic, but just kind of curious if, you know, some thoughts in those areas.
Yeah, so I'll answer your first question and then come back to the health economics issue. So there have been a lot of systematic barriers for surgeon scientists to actually get engaged in research, particularly NIH-funded research. Part of it has to do with the time constraints for surgeons and the kinds of work that they do, which is intensive, very focused, very procedure or operative room oriented. So there's not a lot of room for, sort of experimenting and trying out different things because you're dealing with actual people who are, whose lives depend on what you're doing. So that's been a structural barrier. The other problem that we have had with NIH especially, or any federal grant especially, is that most federal grants have very, I would say, generous, but, you know, from a common man standard, but from a surgeon standard, very low salary caps. So if a surgeon actually gets an NIH grant, his income drops dramatically. So it's like a complete disincentive for any decent surgeon to actually write an NIH grant. Because why would you want to spend 50% of your time being paid, like an average scientist? So it's a complete disincentive. So what we're trying to do is really try to both train them when they're early in their training periods, but also pair them with the scientists. So, I mean, Stanford had actually done a very interesting program. It's called BioDesign, and we've met with them, talked with them. We're trying to adapt that. So what they have done, for example, is that actually their Stanford engineering students, their capstone program or their final year, shadow surgeons for 6 months and come up with ideas with them. They talk to them, they design, and they go back and forth, and then end of their semester, they have to come up with, three new devices, for example. So there are methods like that we can enable surgeons to do their science without actually having to write it and be a bench scientist themselves. So we will try to do more of that. And we're doing a little bit of that with ophthalmology and orthopedics now, just starting to do that. The other area particularly for device industry, is that we have a biomedical engineering project development team that any surgeon can go to. It's spend a couple hours with them and talk to them about their idea. And this includes biomedical engineers from Purdue, from Notre Dame, as well as some from IUPUI. And the idea is that they can talk to this group and they would build their prototype. They would actually work with them. And they will write the grants for them. They will write the whole, even IP for that matter, or an IDE or whatever they need to do. So we're building infrastructure for surgeons to become more entrepreneurial, more successful. So it's going to be an evolution, but there are many structural disincentives we have to deal with.
From their residency?
Yeah, so there's been that additional challenge in that many of these surgical specialties and subspecialty training programs used to have up to 1 or 2 years of research period where they would, a general surgery resident could take their fourth year and simply do research and then come back in fifth year and finish their rotations and be done. So there is increasing pressure. I think the economic pressure helped the economic pressure for them to graduate faster and also support a lot of the clinical service mission of the departments and divisions. So that research period is also getting shortened. Some of them have completely removed it. Others have reduced it to 3 months. In 3 months, you really can't get anything done. You can barely play with things. So I think that's been part of the problem. The health economics issue, I think, we have several programs that we're working on. In fact, this CMS grant I mentioned is all focused on health economics. CMS expects us to manage 11,000 practices and save them $1 billion over the next 4 years. I mean, that's the metric for that grant. So I think we're beginning to get to a place where good science also has to have good economic return. Otherwise, it just becomes science and not good science in the current environment. So I think that's really becoming part of that. So we have, maybe it'll be CTSI 4.0 maybe before NIH gets to that point. But it's coming. It's all coming there.
Yeah. Other questions? I'd like to hear from the audience. Yes.
Dennis?
Hello, Todd.
Yeah, my name's Denny Todd, and I'm sure nobody knows me.
I know you.
I conduct clinical trials here in Indianapolis. We're the only site doing clinical trials as a full-time profession. We've done 500 trials over the years. And no disrespect, but this talk is somewhat underwhelming to me compared to what I heard even 7 years ago when you gave this original talk when you got the grant. If we look more globally, if we look at the states around us, Illinois has 7 research medical schools. Ohio has 6 research medical schools. Michigan has 4. And if you look at us as a state, no wonder we can't take care of our own people. We aren't training enough people, even with the DO medical school starting. And it seems to me, both in terms of education, research, and if you even look at Purdue, you know, they have, last year, 100 patents issued, 20 to 25 new startups. I don't know if they're getting their fair share of CTSI or Notre Dame. The state would do better, not just thinking about this narrow CTSI, but revenue from industry. You know, over the years, I've generated by myself close to $30 to $40 million worth of research money, which could take care of the surgeons because it would come from industry rather than from some NIH grant. And it should be something that IU should be doing in terms of implementing clinical trials phase 2 and phase 3 from the industry, which they aren't doing. You know, the public health issue could be addressed as well if we had more research medical schools. And probably, unfortunately, with Purdue and Notre Dame, if they got their own medical school, which they should, CTSI would not potentially get the funding since they didn't get the funding originally in 2006 without adding other people to the grant.
Is there a question?
Well, I get frustrated when I see Indiana being behind the rest of the world.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I want to respond to Ben.
Right.
Oh, sorry. Danny, we've had this discussion back and forth quite some times, and I do understand your frustration that Indiana is behind in many areas, particularly health outcomes, and. In terms of the industry dollars that come to Indiana, part of the challenge is that Indiana, many of the big companies, even that are in Indiana, are global companies. They go to where the population is. And Indianapolis, the population of maybe a million people, let's say, we do pretty well compared to the rest of the country in the number of clinical trials that we do here. What we don't do as well as I hope we can do is enrolling patients and educating patients about clinical research as we should be. Our population density to people participating in clinical research is far, far lower than New York City or Michigan or any of the other states you mentioned. So part of it has to do with us educating them about the value of clinical research, the benefits of to both to them as well as to society and participating in research. So I think to the extent that we can increase awareness of the value of research in our patients, in our families, in our population, we can improve that substantially. I do understand that you've had a distinguished career in clinical research, but it's not all about the number of trials that we have. It's about the type of transformative trials that we will do, and I think that's where we are focusing on.
Well, the real to give you
one other comment, then I'm going to ask for others in the audience.
Sure, I'm sure I wouldn't get a chance. Never mind.
No.
To use the lipid example, PCSK9, which people don't know about, is the protein that regulates LDL mm-hmm. receptors. We now have two drugs on the market.
Right.
That development actually came from Helen Hobbs from Texas
right.
10 years ago. And how much of IU has been involved in any of those clinical trials? I've done 18. I've worked with all the industry with that. It has showed substantial benefit for patients. There are three vaccines in the mix. There's an RNA interference in the mix. And IU has totally not been part of that. Also, immuno-oncology, there is no immunology department. There is no immuno-oncology program here. You know, our whole oncology, Simon Research, has been fairly substandard. I have a brother-in-law who has to go to Ohio State to get thyroid cancer treatment because there's not anybody with any expertise in that. And they, among a whole bunch of other universities, have that expertise. So we are limited by what little expertise we have at IU as a medical school. If we had more, we wouldn't have this lack of expertise.
Critiques duly noted, I tell you. We're acutely aware of areas that we need to build in. Just to sort of give everybody else a perspective on this, over the next 4 years, we are focusing on immunology, particularly cancer immunology. Some of you may have been at the CTSI annual meeting this year. The keynote speaker and the winner of the Gus Watanabe Award was Carl June, who was, who essentially has transformed T cell based therapies for cancer. And we are, in collaboration with him, we're starting the first CAR T cell therapy trial for multiple myeloma, next month here in Indiana. And we're going to be recruiting a whole host of, infrastructure, including a GMP facility for manufacturing genetically modified T cells. So I take your point that we do have to be ahead of the curve, not behind the curve, in many of these fast evolving areas. The only other comment I'll make is Ohio State has traditionally been a massive cancer center, and they do have very large trials, and it's one of the five. And Deborah might know this history better than I do. When originally NCI, National Cancer Institute, was founded, there were five cancer centers across the country that had a special dispensation from the government. They get 10 cents to every CMS dollar that the institution gets, particularly to the cancer center. So Ohio State, Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, in UCLA were the top five of the five that were. So they have huge resources, very long tradition of having multiple areas of cancer therapies. So it's not surprising that there are areas that people go to in that. So those are just some responses to your comments to put some context.
But
I just wanted to make a quick comment going back to the health of the Indiana population and to say that it's a very multifaceted issue and many contributing factors to the problem and many things will have to contribute to the solution. Indiana's 49th in population in public health funding. That certainly is a contributing factor. But what I'm encouraged by is about 14 hours ago, I was at the Indiana Hospital Association's annual meeting, and the incoming chair, Brian Mills, said almost exactly what you said, observing that the health of the population of Indiana is in the bottom 10%, and that we have to use our resources and focus on that as a problem. And what impresses me about that is that hospitals and providers of care are on the opposite applied side from translational sciences, and if we can get everybody and everybody in between focusing on that problem, I'm very encouraged.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to hear from anybody other. We have about 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes left for questions, and please answer.
Sure. Sure. I'm Matt Morris with Franklin College, and I'm just curious. There were slides talking about workforce development. You talked about training the next generation of scientists. And I'll give a shout-out to Anderson and Lori's alma mater there. But what role do some of the smaller schools in the state play in this? And what's our role in training and participating and providing that human capital? How do we fit in?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and we have, I mean, at least from the CTSI perspective, we have only just started to explore the undergraduate space for what can we do in that area. It's almost easier in at least from our side. That we were able to focus on the high school kids first. We said, okay, we would have summer research experiences for them, 6 weeks internships, where they are exposed to high-end biomedical research, high-end clinical research. But what we haven't fully developed is something between high school and professional schools, the classic undergraduates. We have a few programs with Notre Dame that we're thinking about because they have something called an undergraduate science entrepreneurship types of training programs, but we have not systematically looked at that, and I think that's something we can definitely work with smaller colleges, Ivy Tech, and other schools. That may be training research workforce, not necessarily principal investigators all the time, but variety of other important research resources like coordinators, research assistants, technicians, and technologists, and others who may be essential for the research enterprise. So we have to sit and think through that, and I would welcome any thoughts you might have. If you can just email me, even.
I think another critical part of that, particularly where we're located in rural, and a critical part of that is physician assistants.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Particularly in rural healthcare.
Yes,
but
definitely.
Statewide as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other?
Sorry.
Hi. My name is Renee Becker-Blau, and I'm the executive director of Indiana First. And so I work with highly talented, high school students who are building robots and gaining STEM and teamwork skills and those different pieces. And so you just mentioned, a high school program is encouraging students to get involved with this. Could you expand a little bit more about that? Because, we see a disconnect between what our high school students know about future career opportunities that tie into college that lead to future industries within Indiana. And with Indianapolis being such a hub for this type of work, what can we do on that high school level to help encourage that?
Yeah, no, I think, I'll just give you a thumbnail sketch of what we do, and certainly we can experiment with other things. So we've had a summer internship program for high school students for the last seven years at least. And last summer we had nearly 80 students. All of them come and work in Indianapolis, and they not just work at the medical center or in the hospitals. They have Eli Lilly Laboratories hosts some of them. Other industry partners host them. Some laboratories in even Bloomington and West Lafayette. So the idea is that they are they're immersed in a 6-week research laboratory or a clinic with a mentor, a faculty mentor, and actually work like any other graduate student might work in that space. And they have to, at the end, provide a poster presentation as well as a report that they will have to write. So it's a very intense course for them. Most of them are extremely transformed by that. And about half of them we take are economically or otherwise disadvantaged kids. So many of them come from inner city high schools, Arsenal Tech and others that we have some strong relationship with. So, and that's been an exceptionally successful program. We've had almost every one of them have gone to college and are in, you know, taking science courses. A couple of years ago, we had two kids get into Harvard and Stanford that were from, you know, essentially underprivileged high schools. So I think it's a very transformative program. The problem for us is, the scaling up of that is not easy because we've got to find 70 laboratories that are willing to take a high school kid, host them for 6 weeks, and of course we give them stipends. So we have a few $1,000 stipends as well for that summer. So it's both economically and just in terms of mentor-wise, probably 780 is about as far as I can stretch the system without total rebellion.
Ananta, thank you. Let me join me in a round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's no question. You know, you have challenges ahead of you, and I don't think anybody has their head in the sand. The health status of the country and the area of Indiana here, the overall NIH funding of the entire institution, you cannot have that become a rate limiter for all you're doing. And your integration challenge with all the other assets that are coming to your door.
Yes.
But I hope we've also done a very good job of underscoring some of the immense talent and opportunity that you have in front of you. It's really worthy of note.
No, absolutely. Thank you.
So please join me in thanking Deborah as well.
Yeah.
Again, Deborah Ananta, we certainly thank you for your time this morning and your insight, and it's certainly an engaging and informative discussion. We thank the both of you, as well as Dave Zook, for your efforts in crafting the report, and certainly Ananta, thank you for your leadership in this sector.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having us.
And thank you for everyone for joining us this morning. We certainly hope you found it to be informative. If you have an interest, the website will have the slide deck that Deborah presented today, as well as the CTSI report that Fager BD put together for us. Before we let you go, wanted to thank Miles Printing one last time and look for an announcement for the 2016 frameworks early in 2016. Have a good day.